program?
Yeah, so I'm a professor at Washington State University in the Department of Entomology, and just, I guess since many of you are probably in the Triple Society, some of you may be in the ESA, I'm not sure which. I am a classically trained entomologist, but my roles at the university now include administration, but I still teach a lot. My research interests, I'd say I'm an environmental toxicologist, but my teaching interests, I teach anything from basic biology courses up through graduate level insect physiology. I've been teaching IPM course for a long time. And then I'm also have an appointment in the Extension Service. I'm one of those talking heads who can't shut up when he's supposed to. So what I wanted to is an idea, and this idea of doing more with less. This is an old idea. If some of you are old enough to remember a very innovative visionary engineer named Buckminster Fuller. He came up with this word a long time ago. It's actually the word synergy, which I think has been around here. I've seen this around on some signs and whatnot. And the idea about synergy is actually doing more with less. So that's where I get this idea. So I think we could all probably agree on something, you know, that there's many factors of why we've been very successful in food production to this point, but I think we'd have to say that crop breeding, genetics, maybe is one of the most important things to produce that potential. But that potential is realized because we have other tools like fertilizers and crop protection. Now, you can just look at how successful we've been if you look use USDA statistics and look at our potato production and how we can actually produce about seven times more yield on about a third of the land that we used to. I'd say that's kind of successful. That's maybe a benchmark of sustaining agriculture. These data are already out of date, and interestingly, they're out of date because one thing we always have to consider is how policies can change things. And so what this graph was showing is that until the early 2000s, we were actually growing a lot less corn and getting a lot more yield out of it. But of course, if you remember Bush's, was it 2006 State of the Union, and he mentioned something like switchgrass biofuels in the same vein and set all these new standards for how much biofuel we now have to make from cornstarch. Obviously, you know, you're growing 89, 90 million acres of corn, but if you look at the USDA stats, the yields are still going up. You know, maybe they're plateauing now. The other important thing that I wanted to point out on this graph is there's technologies associated with this. So the key operative word here is associated. That doesn't mean caused, but they happen to be associated, and I think you can make any argument you want. You know, how much did these push that yield? But they have been important, whatever you think about it. So there are some economic studies, not enough economic studies on what value we retrieve from crop protection technologies, but this one from Urit pointing first to the animal problems, which are almost always insects and then, of course, mites and things like that. If you don't do anything, this economist estimates about 70% loss. If you do something, which could include pesticides and other things, you do knock that down, but it's nowhere perfect. The real big difference is when it comes to weed control, where there's about a 9% loss if you're going to treat your weeds, and let's face it, most of that is going to be a herbicide treatment. And if you don't do anything, it's going to be a big, pretty big penalty. And I think when you go to other countries that are non-Western countries, I think weed control is the big issue, and I don't think I'm betraying my classical training as an entomologist that I personally actually think weeds are probably a bigger problem than insect pests. Certainly all the situations are very complex, but you're always going to have weeds, but insects can have very random distributions, and one year they're there and one year they may not be. And if you don't like herbicides, there's a lot of ways to treat weeds if you, you know, are in shape and whatnot. I think another economist analysis from Europe, you know, there's these numbers going, what's the cost-benefit ratio of every dollar you spend for a pesticide? This is a European perspective. I could show you American perspectives, but it's old data already. And, you know, about 20 to 1, but notice the difference between the cost-benefit for insecticides down there on that bottom line versus herbicides. Okay, another economics analysis is very interesting and goes along with Buckminster Fuller's idea of synergy. If we kind of take a look at the total outputs, and then on the bottom flat curve there, we have the total input. So at least this economist analysis, and these are actually USDA ERS Economic Research Service economist. That's where I get this stuff. They're saying, you know, this is not my data. They're just saying, well, you know, our inputs are kind of flat, right? But yet our productivity has increased. So that's good. That's another benchmark of sustaining agricultural resources. Now, I don't care what you call your agronomic system. You know, you look in the literature and go, oh, yeah, this is an organic system on a comparative potential. Well, an organic system is not a scientific system. It is a branding opportunity, okay? That's how you get price premiums. That's what supports the organic market are the price premiums. And it is a rule. It's the USDA Marketing Service controls that rule, the National Organic Program. Conventional is not a scientific term. I don't even know what conventional is. Tell me what you're doing in your system, and I can tell you what you're doing in your system, but it's not, you know, conventional. The same tools can be used by so-called conventional and whatnot. So we use those terms, but they're scientific BS, okay? But it doesn't matter what you call your system, because you're going to need IPM. You're going to need to somehow protect your crop. So this is what IPM is not. It's not a method for reducing pesticide use, although we can show you lots of data that you will likely reduce pesticide use if you practice good IPM principles. It's not a semantic argument to justify more research money, although we do use it, especially in your grants, if you say you're going to reduce pesticide use. It's not an acronym for integrated pesticide management, but in reality, it's a lot of integrated pesticide management. We know that. We especially know that in entomology. And it's not a specific practice. It's a local practice. It has to be a local practice, otherwise it won't work. What it is, and I like a definition that uses something about a decision support system. In the red box there is an old colleague of mine when I was at the University of Illinois, actually came up with one of the best definitions I've ever seen. But it's all wrapped around how do you make a decision to do something. But it has to have these objectives. You have to maintain profitability, right? I don't think we can talk about any sustainable systems unless we talk about people making money, and that money then flows back into the communities. People buy stuff, and it's all one big thing, right? You got to think like an ecologist. You want to minimize selection pressure on pests, and that's both from the viewpoint of pesticide resistance, but also selection pressure in the terms of if you use the wrong pesticide at the wrong time that's not selective, you'll kill the natural biocontrol agents. And you don't want to do that. That's one of our goals, is to avoid that. And then, of course, maintaining environmental quality. So the principles of IPM work like this. First, you got to have your basic biology done. If you cannot identify an organism correctly, you have no key to the treasure trove of all the information we have about the biology. And then once we have that basic biological knowledge, then we study its population ecology, right? We have to know the dynamics of these populations. So I've been teaching pest management type course for a long time, and we spend a lot of time talking about population ecology first before we go anywhere else. The second thing is bioeconomics. You have to have a marriage between the biology and the economics, or what I like to call the markets. The markets are very important in helping you make your decision. Then you have to do And you have to be very vigilant for crop population, both pest and crop population monitoring and surveillance. And one of the things we don't do well, and that's why we have problems with especially herbicide resistance, is we don't do post-treatment surveillance to see what's still out there that we need to take care of. It's a behavioral problem, not a technology problem. And then finally, you want to deploy practices that are complementary and compatible with one another. And that means the first line of defense is prevention. Some people say avoidance. Don't get the problem in the first place. Now, that's systems are very complex. It's very hard to do. If that fails, then you go to the medicine, what we call the therapeutics. And that's how we teach this stuff. We talk about pesticides at the end of all this other stuff. Okay, so what are some of the compatible tactics for prevention here? And this is really important because I'm thinking more like an entomologist now, so I'm thinking about insects, but I think a lot of these concepts might be applicable also to weeds and diseases. But you can focus first for prevention on the pest itself, lowering its pest density. We have an array of things we talk about, and we show the students the research and whatnot. Of course, all the research is small plots and whatnot. We don't have large-scale experiments which give you different results. And the bottom there is plant insect-resistant cultivars. So in entomology departments, I think there's still some left that teach something called host plant resistance. There's a whole course in that. That's what we call it. Then if we look at lowering economic damage level, what we're trying to do is make the system more resilient by allowing those plants all the requisite sources that they need to overcome any pest pressure. And again, the first thing on that list is host plant resistance. And then there's a lot of other things you can do. I mean, I when I drive up the Northern Gorge in my state and there's lots of grapes and apples, whatnot, I'm seeing people put up these big telephone poles and these nets that they can literally wrap 20, 40, 50, 60 acres of orchard in. That's what people are doing. That's already out there. All right, now, pesticides will achieve all of this. But the problem is, until relatively recently, maybe going back, I'll go maybe back 20 years relatively recently, our older compounds were too broad spectrum, so they were not durable long-term solutions. So, and what I'm going to be talking about is how things have changed. But we still want to see them as the last resort after trying all these other things, or incorporating all these other things. Okay, so if prevention is inadequate, the difference among the agronomic systems, whether you say I'm certified organic, I'm whatever, it's about picking your own poison. All you have to do is visit your state's, I'm sure most of your state's departments of agriculture, ours does, has their own organic program. It has to mesh with the national organic program rules. But there's lots of stuff you can use there. We don't have a lot of data on what organic growers are using, but what data we have shows they use them as much as other types of growers. No, of course not. But it's there if you need it. All right, so where have we been? And that's not a mistake on that slide. It says where were we, what I meant to say is where were we headed? And I say where we headed because these data, which again are from the USDA National Agricultural Service, the Economist, it's ends in 2010. I don't know what's, you know, we don't have the collected data between now and looking back 5 years. We'll get that data, and the only way to add it to this data is to use their particular method. So I can go in the databases and add to it, but it's not necessarily comparative. The important thing is policies can change things, but this is where we've been. I think this is really important to keep this in mind. If you look at total pesticide use, which is dominated by herbicide use for good reason, it goes along with what I was saying before, weeds are a much bigger problem than any other particular pest, things have been pretty stable. Even herbicide use has been very stable. Now, we've seen some interesting trends there. If you look around the area of, say, 1980-ish or so, you notice how it starts going down, because this graph is in pounds, all right? Well, it started going down because of the chemistry. Chemistry was very smart. It's a group of compounds invented by DuPont scientists called sulfonylureas. Then an old company, which is now BASF, American Cyanamid, comes out with imidazolinones. But sulfonylureas are really cool because they're affected at literally low grams per hectare. The imidazolinones takes a little bit higher, right? So people started adapting this. Of course, the problem is resistance is a monogenic character, so resistance just blew up in everybody's face really badly. But because they were using less stuff to do more weed control, and these things are very potent. And believe me, I, being a toxicologist or at least doing research in that, these things are, I'm going to use the word safe, although that's not a scientific term either. I want you to also look at insecticides in red. They're going down, 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 and actually the trend is even lower now, looking at current 2015 data. And because insecticides, for the most part, still rely on targeting neurophysiology, and evolutionarily speaking, all nerve cells work the same way no matter where your lineage is, you know, that can be a problem. But here's the thing. You have to actually understand the concept of selectivity. You have to know something about biochemistry to realize that even though you can target the nervous system, it is very possible, I mean, not only possible, it exists, you can make a chemical that is only selective for an insect, yet alone you can make it selective for just a particular order of insects and not selective to anything and not, you know, going to hit anything else. All right. Last year on the extension circuit, somebody asked me to talk about how does IPM shift what pesticides we're using. So I came up with a bunch of factors. And almost in the middle of the first time I gave the talks, I always refine them after I give them, I had this epiphany, and I realized that something that we kind of ignore, one of the most important things, is the technology itself. It's changed a lot. I saw a talk yesterday by Ralph Naughan, who's really a biochemist, a biochemical toxicologist there in Germany. This guy publishes a lot about exactly what is the target that something's hitting on, and what is the potency of it, and you know, this thing about things meeting targets is a very, very important concept in biochemical kinetics, all right? And it explains why there's selectivity. And I would hold that synthetic organic chemistry and what we're capable of doing now and analyzing how things interact with other things is light years ahead of what we were before. And this is actually what's going to help us actually make IPM systems easier to facilitate. All right. So on that theme, I'll remind you that this reduced risk pesticide program EPA came up with actually preceded the Food Quality Protection Act, but it was mandated in the amendment to FIFRA, Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act. Now, here's the thing. In public consciousness, thinks industry is always thinking one way and always about profits. But notice that by 1997, and so reduced risk is lower risk, but it's lower toxicity this, lower toxicity that, you know, lower potential for runoff, blah, blah, blah. But the bottom of the list that EPA gives you on what they mean by reduced risk is compatibility with integrated pest management systems. But by 1997, the point is 22 compounds were already approved under EPA's reduced risk status. Now, that's not because companies saw that the law was changing. We're going to invent something. They were already working on them maybe 10 years ago. That's how long it takes to develop these compounds. That shows you the whole industry, you know, regardless of what the media thinks about the industry, you know, they were already changing. And we have to live with that reality. All right. So to kind of illustrate what I mean by the reduced risk, you just look at the oral LD50s, dermal LD50s. And red there is the old stuff. Let's call that the conventional stuff. And really what's important for risk assessment is the no observable adverse effect levels. All right. And so those numbers are very high. The higher the number, you know, relatively more comparatively safe. Take a look at the Fisher. Everything is in blue or it's reduced risk. You can see that it takes a lot more stuff to kill fish today with this new chemistry. Daphnia, okay, got some exceptions. Novaluron is a chitin synthesis inhibitor. So, yeah, we know that's bad, but you use so little of that stuff, it's not going to be an environmental hazard. Birds, things are much safer for birds. We do get some weird ones like indoxacarb. And then, interestingly, doing more or less, this theme is you use a lot less of these things, right? I need to actually update this list because it's already about 4 or 5 years old, and already new things have come along that could easily fit into that paradigm. Just want to show you very quickly. This is an experiment, old colleague of mine, Art Agnello, up at the Geneva, I think he's in Geneva or Cannell. They tried comparing so-called reduced risk tools to conventional in apple production, number of different pests. So the conventional they call standard, and you can see the difference there in terms of the kilograms of pesticide it took in comparative to food systems. Very smaller amounts had to be used. You can do environmental impact quotients. I particularly don't like them as a toxicologist, but a lot of people use them. The bigger the number, the perceived greater risk to the environment and workers and stuff. You can see these are much, much lower numbers with the new kinds of chemicals. And then finally, you know, what's really important for growers is their income. And it's actually more expensive because they throw in mating disruption, which requires hand delivery of dispensers on every so many trees, so it's and the stuff expensive. But that doesn't matter because what matters is the return, the profit, and the profits are just as good, right? So that's a good selling point. You may spend a little up front, but you're going to get more back at the end. And then finally, I had synthetic biology in one of my slides someplace. Genetic engineering is nothing but host plant resistance, folks. That's all it is, okay? We don't have time to argue all the molecular biology and evolutionary biology. But here's an independent study. German economists put this out last year showing what they think from an economic aggregate perspective are some benefits are. So yields seem to be up, whether it's herbicide-resistant or insect-resistant crops. Pesticide quantities are down. Maybe there's a little bit blip more on the herbicides. Pesticide costs are down, et cetera. The most important thing, though, if you want to sell systems to people that actually farm for a living, you got to have profit, and at least the aggregate economic data is showing profit. So I was going to say we do have a disjunct in understanding of host plant resistance with the public. I forgot to put that up there. Okay, so let me end by not reiterating what I said, but giving you some cautionary conclusions. When I listen to the debate about, and I don't know why it's a debate, but we use the word sustainable agriculture, people talk about it, I hear people talking about technology as if it was 30 years ago. Man, get with the program. Yeah, you need to understand where we are with chemistry today. It's not 30 years ago. We need to quit framing our debates as if we existed 30 years ago. Technologies are dynamic. When crop protection and plant breeding technology is proven effective and has benefits, and I, you know, we could show that there's more environmental benefits today, adoption is going to be very rapid. And we have regulatory control like crazy. As a matter of fact, I've argued before that if you want to know what the precautionary principle looks like when you actually implement it in a realistic condition, you better understand the pesticide laws in the United States and how it works, because that is implementation of the precautionary principle. The other problem I see is people mistake the tools of the trade as being equivalent to the system. So if somebody uses a pesticide of whatever kind, they think that has somehow is equal to the system, and it's not. These are just tools, and using these tools appropriately and integrating them will achieve the goals of equitability, access to productivity achievements, and really freeing people to pursue independence. If you don't have economic independence, it's very difficult to get any type of justice in the system. Thank you very much.